Welcome back to part two of Confessions of a Mormon Swinger. In part one, we heard the story of a man we're going to call Jay. Now, his name isn't really Jay. Or maybe it is, and I just want you to think that it isn't. Or maybe I know that you're all especially clever kinds of listeners who would expect me to give a false name, and I knew that you knew that I knew that, and so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of me.
Inconceivable!
Anyway.
You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
If you're like me, after listening to part one, you just had to find someone to talk to about it. Well, part two is our attempt to help you vicariously scratch that itch by listening into a panel discussion between myself, Matt, Bob, Randy, and our special guest, Jay. But before we start, I want to thank those of you who have commented on our website and on the Facebook groups. Those comments are really the best kind of support that you can give us. So, as always, if you like what you hear, please let us know on our website at infantsonthrones.com or through our Facebook page, or by writing up a nice 5-star review on iTunes. That's really what makes this all worthwhile.
This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
So we can't just leave this hanging with this guy's story. As is Infants on Thrones pattern, we have to pick it apart as well and take what was a very good interview and beat a dead horse.
Right.
So we've got a great panel to discuss what, without hyperbole, was a riveting interview. Good job, Glenn.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
So I'm Matt, and with me is Glenn.
Hello.
Who else we got? Bob.
Hi there.
And we can't do a podcast without Randy.
Not without the angry atheist.
And Jay's on with us as well. And you know, we've never met, but I hope you'll allow us to be honest and open. But at the same time, know that there's no personal judgment, but we'll try our best to be honest about our reactions and some concerns or thoughts or reactions we have to your interview. But at the end of the day, give you a chance to explain yourself and or at least explain your perspective. Is that fair?
Yeah, oh, absolutely fair. And just in full disclosure, I'm not alone here. I am sitting here with my wife. She's going to be keeping an ear out for everything that I say. She was on the original interview as well. We didn't really mention that during the time. She was offered to come on and give her voice as well, but she really just wanted to sit there and keep me on track. So she's here. And, you know, I'm not worried about this panel discussion. I listen to you guys enough. I wouldn't be here if I didn't already kind of know what I was in for, right?
So tell the truth. Who are you most – whose reaction were you most worried about on this panel?
Probably those two guys who aren't on.
Yeah. So Jesse and Tom?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, Bob, Glenn, or Randy, do you guys have any – just your initial reaction while you were listening to the interview?
Should we talk about the book Sex – I mean, it kind of started with the book Sex at Dawn. So did any of you guys – have any of you guys read that book?
No, I did some research on it just because I, you know, when it came up in the interview, I was interested about it. I went and I read the Wikipedia summary of it with some of the criticisms that were on there, and there's a Huffington Post piece that the author write. What's his name? It's
this is our crack research team. I've yeah. actually read the book and I don't know the name of the author.
It's Christopher Ryan.
That's it. Yeah. Christopher Ryan wrote a Huffington Post piece, which was like 7 things that we can learn from the bonobos. It was kind of a gag for Valentine's Day, but I read that. But I haven't actually read the book.
You know, I've never read the book either. I do have friends that talk about it all the time and says it was something that was very influential with them, that they thought it was very insightful. And I also have friends who listen to the Savage Love podcast. And apparently he promotes it all the time. So although
is that
I'm not
Dan Savage?
Yeah, I think it is. Savage Love. Yeah, Savage Love podcast, Dan Savage. But so I have people that have talked about it, although I've never read it. We did a group of friends just did a book club on it recently that I didn't attend just because I really didn't have all that much interest in reading it. But I understand the basic gist of it, which I think Jay basically summarized what I've heard from other people about it.
Yeah, it's a pretty well-known book in the ex-Mormon swinging scene.
Well, I've actually read the book, and it's an evolutionary psychology book, so the odds are that I would have read the book, but it's a very interesting book. It's an interesting hypothesis. It explains, explains really well human nature and sexuality, but it's very important to say, and I don't know if you agree, Jay, but it's a very controversial hypothesis. It's one that is in the very small minority among evolutionary psychologists. And the book does kind of go after some of my, some of my heroes in science, but real pillars in this field like Jared Diamond and Steven Pinker, and harshly criticizes them. But what I found was that some of the criticisms they had for those other people that oppose them, some of those things they criticize for, they're guilty of themselves. I don't know. Do you agree, Jay?
Yeah, I agree. It's controversial because it flies in the face of everything that came before it. And, you know, when I read it, it was almost too convincing. So it nearly made me feel uncomfortable. So I asked a couple of my friends to take a look at it for me so we could discuss it. But
okay, so Jay, I've got to ask you this though, because you're saying that it was too convincing and that it made you uncomfortable,
yeah.
But at the same time, it was kind of validating these desires that you had. So why was that uncomfortable? Why wasn't it that you were reading this and going, all right, yeah, these feelings that I have inside, there's a reason for it. There's this genetic explanation that makes sense.
It's because I did feel that. It made so much sense to me. You know, it's kind of like, I hate trite sayings like this, but it seemed too good to be true. And, you know, when I left the church, I became a skeptic. And, you know, in the true sense of the word, a skeptic challenges everything they see, especially those things that seem completely convincing. So I had to ask myself, am I falling back into familiar patterns of acceptance based on, you know, confirmation bias or anything like that?
So what's the controversial part of this finding, of this book, that so many people don't agree on? Because if the basic premise is monogamy isn't the natural human state or whatever, I'm probably way oversimplifying it. To me, it just sounds like one of those uncomfortable truths that people don't want to talk about, less than it is something that can't be analyzed like any other scientific finding potentially.
This question is such a difficult question to answer. There's actually a segment of the book where the author is at a scientific conference, and he tells another scientist what he's trying to do. And the guy said, well, you might as well just close your eyes and imagine, because how are you going to collect evidence for your hypothesis? So it's almost an unanswerable question. And the thing that it really fights against is the Hobbesian view of pre-agricultural humans and these immediate return hunter-gatherer groups. What was life like before agriculture made us sedentary? And there's just not any way to really gather a lot of evidence. And so you could make up any hypothesis. You could probably come up with like three or four hypotheses that would explain why so many marriages fail, why eyes stray after a certain amount of time when a relationship gets stale or stagnant. So it really doesn't matter. Like you said, Bob, it is, and I hate cliches like this, especially tautology cliches, it is what it is.
least favorite phrase in all the history of humankind.
Yes. So it is, and whether or not somebody, you know, somebody's hypothesis is right or not, it is. And how do you deal with it? And that's the bottom line.
Yeah, and let's assume the premise of the book is true, and that is that we are evolutionarily. Thank you. Kind of brought up to have these traits or have these this disposition. My thought is, so what? Aren't we? Doesn't that same evolution also lend us to be violent and want to maybe react in violence? That's what separates us from animals and maybe less lesser creatures or whatever, is because we can not act on those things that might give us this kind of gut reaction, whether it be violence, whether it be sexual, whether it be otherwise. So even if
you're talking about the is-ought fallacy, right? Like, just because it is doesn't mean that's the way we ought to act.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, but I find it fascinating that society has chosen, through the rule of law, to approach these two subjects, you know, vastly differently from each other. So killing people or being violent is on a whole other plane, but there's a reason why sexual indiscretion and not being faithful, you know, the consequences are limited by comparison, right? So what does that say?
It says our lawmakers are covering their asses.
There you go. That they're just like the rest of us, theoretically, if we're all experiencing the same evolutionary or biological set of traits.
See, but you don't need to turn for science for that. You can just look in the Book of Mormon, where the natural man is the enemy to God.
And we come full circle.
Boom, bang, baby.
But, you know, I brought this up in the first interview, and that's the point. What happens in our society when there is an indiscretion? Because in our society, there's a script that somebody cheats, the other spouse leaves. But when you understand it that way, you can ask yourself, does that really have to happen?
And that part was, I thought, profound. And I think you highlighting that is something that, just as a married person, I had to think about is why are we, conditioned to say that any type of indiscretion, that must equal the end of the relationship and everything that might have been built up for years before that. So I think that point, that's a complicated issue, but it's one that I think is at least should be considered by people who are married and who take on serious responsibilities and commitments.
Well, and isn't the answer to that question, though, it goes to trust? And if somebody if you can't trust your spouse anymore, you know, you can't really respect them anymore, the love's diluted, and it's hard to be in a situation like that. So I think what Jay tried to do to mitigate that risk was to have an open dialogue with his wife so that they weren't, you know, they set up these rules so that it wasn't being done in dishonesty. You couldn't violate trust. I'm speaking for you, Jay, but that's kind of what I took away from your approach. Is that right?
Yeah, it's like we talked about when you brought up Joseph Smith. It wasn't so much the act of sex that was the problem for me when I left the church. It was the dishonesty and, you know, the way that he promised exaltation for marriage and, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, when you leave the Mormon church, you have to think for yourself and come up with your own set of morality. And, you know, I'm a secular humanist, and so I...
You and Randy would get along, then.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I listen to you guys a lot, and I usually agree with what Randy has to say, and maybe have a little man crush. He's kind of my favorite.
Yeah, he's his favorite, too.
Well, somebody's got to be friends with him, so...
Hey, I'm friends with Randy.
Well, so, you know, you have to decide for yourself what's right and wrong when it comes to sex. Is it, you know, different body parts penetrating other body parts? Or is it about trust and honesty and, you know, abuse of all of these things? And so, you know, since we were both married so young, my wife and I both had, you know, curiosity as to what sex would be like with another person. And, you know, maybe it started with me, but certainly she began feeling that same way as well. So it seemed if we're going to explore this curiosity, we should do it together, and it should be completely open and honest, and that's why we created the rules that we did, to try and keep it more moral, as the way that we define morality. You know, if we do it together, who's the victim? Where's the real harm?
Well, I think that's that. I mean, I think there are answers to that question, because you guys aren't the first people in the history of the world to do anything like this, or to risk what happens when you engage in sex with other people. And I think, as you found out, it's really hard to detach the act of sex from the feelings that develop around it. And, you know, so if you did find yourself in a position where there was a point of no return, you really couldn't get back to each other, because you developed these feelings for someone else, and that's where you want to be now, and you have kids, those kids are the ones that are the victims that have really lost out on these choices that you've made.
Yeah, but the kids could become a victim if we never actually acted on these thoughts or did it in the way that we did it, and one of us stepped out on the other, so, you know, that could happen.
Sure.
So you could make an argument that the way we did it put the kids less at risk.
Well, let me highlight this point then, and Glenn was kind of asking it, and I think it was touched on. So approaching this idea of opening a marriage is a way to circumvent the risk of adultery or an affair. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I don't think there was any conscious choice that we were doing this to avoid adultery. It was more just a respect for the relationship that we had, that I didn't want to do anything without her, really. I wanted her to be part of this. And, you know, because I, like I said, I had this this desire, and it was like an itch that just kept nagging at me that needed to be scratched. Because people might not understand exactly how important, how drilled into your head this is as part of Mormon culture, that you do not step out of these bounds. And so I really never did. And then when I realized, oh, that was a bunch of BS, I thought, okay, I really missed out on an opportunity, and I did feel like the church was responsible for that.
I got married pretty young too. Jen was 19 and I was 22 when we got married. And we together didn't have much experience either. And so I empathize with that. I mean, I'm not saying that I don't think I could ever, because I know myself and I'm such a jealous person, and I've always been, I was a jealous boyfriend when I was single, and I don't think that I could pull this off, but I do empathize with, the curiosity that Jay has. I mean, I think that's just human nature.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, the jealousy thing, that was definitely me too. I really think that's where this experiment kind of failed in the end, you know?
Well, Jay said something in his interview, and I wrote it down, I think, verbatim. And he says, and I'm interested to get everyone, the rest of the panel's take on this. He said that he felt that the church robbed him of something he was owed. And there's a couple ideas there. First of all, that he was owed something in his life, some experiences. And secondly, that the church as an institution robbed him.
Well, can I just stop you there? I listened back to what I said earlier, and I think it came off too strong. You know, if I had it to say again, I wouldn't say that I was owed this. What I meant was, it just seems like such a natural part of everybody's existence, but it was withheld from me because of my faithfulness in the church and my commitment to the church. So that's really what I meant by saying that. then who knows? You know, maybe I would have been really terrible at sex. So, you know, maybe the church saved me from a bunch of high school pain and suffering. You know?
Well, and that's my question for the panel for Glenn, Randy, Bob, and I guess myself is. Did what Jay say resonate with any of you?
Yes and no. So let me answer this with a little bit of a question for Jay, because I'm curious if the itch has been scratched, if there's anything else that Jay wants to experience. Because I think there is a redefining process for anyone who's a sexual being, which is all of us, who is also happens to be raised Mormon in a very conservative lifestyle, and then is taught certain things and then determines that all those things aren't necessarily accurate. So, for example, pornography, what that means to me is different now than what it used to mean to me previously. It's something that doesn't bother me. And, you know, I enjoy it like anyone else who is willing to admit that. It's not something that I obsess over either, but apparently that wasn't enough for Jay. And it's not enough for other people who haven't experienced things that they weren't able to do in the past that they now want to do because they're freer from the church, right? So I'm just wondering, I know that's, I don't mean to put Jay in a tough spot here, because that's maybe an unfair comparison, because there's a big leap from, you know, all of a sudden being allowed to watch porn to having sex with women after you're married and in a state where you wish you could have done that before this stage of your life. So, but the reason I phrase it that way, because I feel like it's a spectrum with lots of other options in between. But if you've got like porn, sex, group sex, you know, slippery slope down the road that everybody likes to throw out, where does this go? I'm just curious if you
want to know if Jay's lining up the animals.
No, I'm not doing that. But I think our story shows that the slippery slope fallacy is exactly that. It's a fallacy. It never spun out of control because, you know, we put all these controls into it. We had our rules and we had open communication. And, yeah, my wife did break my trust, but a lot of that was because I was just so jealous all the time, and she just got tired of that. But, you know, we went into this with eyes wide open, holding hands, and an eject button. And I don't think I made this clear in the first interview, but she was actually the one who said that we should stop it because she saw how much it was hurting me, and she never wants to hurt me. So she's the one who hit eject, and that was one of the controls that we put in, you know, at the very beginning. So... no, I don't think that things ever really spiraled out of control.
And I don't mean to support a fallacy if that's what I'm doing here, but I am curious.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying.
What I hear you saying, Bob, can I jump in here? What I hear you saying is that it feels a bit like a ex-Mormon Rumspringa, like an Amish. You know, this is a chance to experience all these types of things that you never got to if you were your family converted when you were like 9 or 10 years old or something like that. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I was 9.
So since you were a child up through adulthood, you've not experienced these things. And I attribute that to kind of a Rumspringa. And there are certainly reports of other ex-Mormons doing that as it pertains to alcohol, sometimes recreational drug use, and certainly as it relates to opening up the borders of sexuality.
Right. And I feel like, just to take that one step further, most of us on this panel have probably done something similar in the sense that, well, I guess I'll just speak for myself openly. Like, I never drank alcohol before leaving the Mormon church. Then I drank it, and I experienced getting drunk for the first time, which was more than never having been drunk before.
Oh, yeah, I can speak to that.
Yeah. So in that same way, there are some other things that I was very, you know, reserved about, and not going into details in terms of sexual stuff. But I would say in general, most Mormons are very shy and they're sort of repressing certain things. And then once they get past that stage, if they're in a healthy relationship, they can experience sexual things in a way that doesn't necessarily involve bringing in other couples or people that they're not married to. And for most of them, myself included, that seems like, you know, there you go. Then you feel bad that you didn't get to do something when you were, you know, in your early 20s before you were married. But, you sort of scratch the itch through some of the new things you could maybe do that you didn't feel comfortable doing when you were an active Mormon, but you didn't feel like you had to go to the next level of like recreating history.
Well, so how long will scratching that new itch in that different way really last?
Well, that's what I'm asking. That's why I'm wondering why between point A and B of, just to label this very simply, of like not being, let's just use this as an example. Let's say state A is not being able to watch porn. State B is being able to watch porn. And then state C is there's a lot between B and C, but state C is having sex with other women. So there is some progression, because these are things that you couldn't do that were slightly more than what you could do before, but not as much as the next thing in the cycle. And so I'm just wondering, clearly doing B didn't scratch your itch enough, and C now has, and it isn't going to lead to D for some reason, even though B could arguably be labeled as something that led to C. Does that make sense?
Okay, so your slope is not quite as slippery. It's a little bit slower, less. I mean, there's a little more viscosity on the slope, I guess, is what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's just that most ex-Mormons scratch these itches and then they move on, but they don't necessarily, you know, have to jump into the deep end of the pool. They just dip their toe in, and they don't become alcoholics. They don't have to have sex with other married couples, those sorts of things. And it's sort of, in some ways, Jay, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but it sort of fuels the fire of the active Mormons to assume that this is the natural consequence of any Mormon experiencing more than what they're supposed to, because it's just going to lead to this. So I want to hear you explain why, how it led to what you ended up doing isn't something that, you know, it should be the same experience for everyone else. Why it led that way for you, but that isn't what biologically would be the outcome for everyone else or for Mormons in general.
Well, you know, in any relationship, there are only so many ways that you can really, you know, mix things up before they just become routine. And, you know, if I can find a way to mix things up and create more excitement in the bedroom and still do it in a moral way, you know, an honest, respectful, fair way, well, then why not do it? Because, you know, I think we'd all agree that a healthy and exciting sex life is a critical component of a healthy and successful marriage. So if the drive for sexual novelty is really part of our nature and we can do it in a careful way, why not try it and take responsibility for our own morals and our own actions and, you know, just see if it works.
Let me ask you this. Do you feel like it's a legitimate argument for an active Mormon to suggest that ex-Mormons are more prone to this behavior simply because they are likely not to have experienced it previously in life, like regular non-believers who don't, you know, refrain from sexual activity before marriage? So I guess the church could be to blame in some ways, but in other ways, this is just, in some ways, I could see Mormons, like, since they're bought into this belief system, wanting to hold on even more because there's a legitimate claim here that Mormons who leave the church do have stronger tendencies to do the rumspringa thing and go too far by whatever societal standards. And that's going to make it so that the cycle's even tighter, and Mormons are going to not want to accept that ex-Mormons are normal people like everyone else in society because of examples like you, Jay, where it's because of being an ex-Mormon after being a Mormon who's been repressed that this led to this, you know, the situation led to this.
You know, you can find the most socially liberal person out there and you bring up open marriage and they become the most socially conservative person in that one area. And I think that's social conditioning. It's a relic of our early Puritan culture. And in my case, at least, and I think it's like this for a lot of ex-Mormons, it's part of that puritanical tradition within Mormonism. Because, you know, I was always told that, you know, what was right and wrong as if it were universal law coming directly from God himself. And, you know, I had that until my mid-30s. And these are, so there were a lot of lessons that I never learned firsthand when I was younger, like a lot of other people do. And so when you let go of that dogmatic worldview and you come face to face with your own emotional underdevelopment, you have to grow up really fast. And I don't know, so maybe you regress into some sophomoric behavior. Maybe that's what's going on.
So Jay, I mean, did you think that, I mean, were you worried about becoming, you know, kind of a cliche, an ex-Mormon cliche?
Sure, and that's one of the main reasons why I want to protect my identity, you know. I have family members that would hear this and look at me, and they'd look at what I've done and not understand my reasons for doing it at all. It would just feed into this narrative of, yep, that's what happens when someone lets go of the iron rod. And, yeah, that would really upset me.
But it does support that narrative, and you just don't want to?
No, it doesn't support that narrative, because that narrative is too oversimplified. It doesn't take into consideration any of the reasons why we approached it the way that we did. It's just, you know, far too black and white for that. And my story isn't the same experience that other ex-Mormons go through, so I don't want them all to be lumped into one standard narrative that can just, you know, sweep away all of the things that I thought about as I was going into this. You know, and it also assumes the negative, like it's some kind of a failure, instead of acknowledging the fact that there are married couples who go through this, and they are much happier, and their marriage is much stronger than it was even before they opened up their marriage. So
you just said two things there that I want to respond to both of them, but I can't because they'll take us in different directions. But the one of them, you know, you were talking about the simplicity of the Mormon narrative, and one of the things that feeds into that is that wickedness never was happiness.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
But here you're just now saying that a lot of these couples that are doing this are happier than they have been before. And so I think where it falls apart for you isn't that it's too simplistic and it doesn't get all the complexities of what's going on, is that it's so judgmental and it's saying this is wickedness, when from your experience there isn't really anything inherently wicked about it. It's just, you know, disobedient to these commandments that you now see as being very arbitrary commandments. Is that the problem that you have with the ex-Mormon narrative thing?
Yeah, I think you just summed it up nicely. I don't really have anything to add to that.
Good, because now I can go to the second question, where you talk about...
It sounds like Matt wants to chime in.
Okay, he can in a minute. Okay. But you talk about a good marriage. Like, if you have a really good marriage, then you're going to be on solid ground. So this is what I was thinking through throughout the interview, and as I've listened back to it, it really... I think the value of exploring a story like this is that you can look at these elements of a good marriage and try to understand what they are. And so that's kind of where I want to take the discussion a little bit. What does it mean when you say that you have a good marriage? What is it? What makes up a good marriage?
Well, there's no standard checklist for a good marriage. It just simplifies this all over again, and it makes it like, do you have a temple recommend? Do you pay your tithing? Are you filling your calling? You know,
there's
no real checklist.
But it has to mean something, so I'm asking what it means.
Well, it does mean something. I think a good litmus test for a good marriage is how much time you like to spend together. You know, do you enjoy being around each other? Are they the person that you first want to share success with, or the person you seek out when you're suffering? It's all very subjective. You know, there's no universal objective criterion for a good quote-unquote marriage.
All right, well, that kind of brings me to what I've been wanting to talk about. And it's a theme that keeps coming up, at least in my mind, every time you talk, Jay. And it's this idea of having a strong marriage. We want to do this together. We want to have open and honest communication and these types of things. What I'm interested in is that the result of that was we want an open marriage, not we want to swing. And there's
actually, Matt, I don't know if it was, and Jay, you know, correct me if you're wrong, if I'm wrong, but there are two. Is this what you're getting at, Matt? There are distinct differences in opening a marriage. Are you talking about polyamorous versus just swinging?
Yeah, the idea of swinging or the lifestyle versus an open marriage.
Yes. So, there's definitely a difference between polyamorous and swinging. And polyamorous people generally don't engage in swinging. They are out there looking for other boyfriends, girlfriends to bring into this really complicated. I can't even imagine how people pull this off. It's definitely not for me, but it sounds like it's not for you either, Jay, but each spouse will have one or two or three different boyfriends, girlfriends, and they will all be open and the kids are open and brought in on it. Whereas swinging is kind of like something is like a hobby you do on the weekends and you don't make breakfast for anyone. Act of sex, it's just
is
like
swinging more like with partners.
It's definitely a partner thing. Whereas polyamorous, from what I've read, is going out and establishing like actual, real emotional and sexual relationships with other people. Is that correct, Jay?
I don't know if you can simplify it quite as simple as that, but. Polyamorous is certainly developing the feelings for people, and that's not anything that I was interested in doing.
So if I'm hearing that, if I accept that as true, you have swinging, which is my limited research here today after listening to the podcast, was it is very recreational. It's equivalent to going and playing racquetball with somebody. But generally, the other spouse is going to be participating in many cases the same room, or at least the same event. There may be some partnering off, or what you kind of think of as wife swapping or spouse swapping, but the event or the encounter is mutual. That is both engaging in the encounter at the same event and generally in the same room. That's swinging or spouse swapping. Then there's this polyamorous, which is developing relationships beyond just the event. But then there's this third thing, which Jay seemed to have been talking about, which is an open marriage, which is you do your thing separately, I do my thing separately, and neither the two shall meet. Those things seem. I think it's important to highlight those distinctions and the differences and some of the pitfalls that are associated with each one.
Yeah. So there is that category of open marriage, I guess, where. You know, there aren't really the rules that we put into place. It's just much more open. I can think of an example. An old girlfriend of mine from high school who's currently in an open marriage. But in her case, she's the only one in that relationship that's going out and having sex with other guys. You know, her husband isn't having sex with women. He doesn't do it. He's not interested in it. He kind of did that and went under his, it's under his belt. And so the part that he likes is hearing her describe it when she gets home. It's a turn on to him. And then they end up having great sex because of it. And, you know, so that makes it work. But that obviously isn't what I was interested in going into this. You know, I wanted to participate in it. And so ours was sort of open, I guess, but we put those rules into place to try and keep it fair and balanced. And, you know, because we had a strong marriage, I felt that we could do that pretty safely. You know, I also have another friend whose wife cheated on him. She stepped out and he eventually found out. You know, she tried to hide it, but it created a lot of conflict in their marriage. But you know, in their case, their marriage wasn't very strong at all. They were like two people leading these parallel lives. And there was a lot of hiding and secrecy and really not a lot of respect for the other person. But when he confronted her, she offered him an open marriage as a way to stay together. And, you know, they had kids. And so, it seemed like it could be an option, at least from her perspective. But he refused it. He wasn't interested in that at all, partly because he didn't want to have to go through the kinds of things that I went through trying to find a woman and either lie to her or explain your whole open marriage thing. But he also didn't feel like he was even in a marriage at all in the first place. So how could it be open if it wasn't ever really even closed, you know? So I think she just wanted to keep his health care benefits and avoid the financial complications of divorce, but that's not really a marriage. So there are a lot of variables going into all of this, and whether you label it an open marriage or swinging or polyamorous relationship, you know, no one has exactly the same story.
Isn't there, Jay, did it run through your mind the whole mutually assured destruction scenario, Mormon style? Like, I'm sure the other ex-Mormon couple is similar to you and your wife in that I can't imagine an ex-Mormon couple being totally comfortable with anybody knowing about this. So the more people you involve in your circle of swingers, the more, you know, there's a statistical probability that keeps rising that something's going to get out. And that would just drive me nuts.
Because the next thing you know, somebody's writing an expositor, printing presses are being destroyed.
And the mob is shooting you in the face.
The mob shooting you in the face, yeah.
Hey, we've seen this before.
Right.
So are you afraid that you're going to get shot in the face?
See, no, I'm just worried about getting shot down every time I try to pick up on a woman at a bar. That was a terrible experience, and I may not have expressed it very much in that first interview, but it's not something that I did very often, and I didn't really even enjoy doing it at all.
Well, wait a second, though. Let's talk about that, because you made it really clear, at least I thought in that first interview, that it didn't work out like you were hoping. I don't know how many tries before you came to that conclusion, but it sounds like your wife, Jay, you know, she would get a hit like each time she put the bait in the water, so to speak. But you were like fishing all day, and you just decided fishing sucks because
like any bite.
It was very stressful for me. You know, my wife had a friend who knew what was going on, and she was okay with it, and so they could go to ladies' night together and have a lot of fun. But you know, I didn't have a friend like that. It was just me. And you know, if I was out at a bar with my friends and they know that I'm married and I'm hitting on women, then, you know, I'm a big jerk. So I just had to go out all alone. And, you know, you guys try it. Just go out and try it for fun. Sitting at a bar all alone on a Friday night trying to pick up on women, and you just feel like a loser. So, you know, there was a huge asymmetry in the way that this all played out. And that was probably a big part of the problem for me.
Right, and I guess I want to ask, do you feel specifically, you know, there's no study on this, or at least not that I've read. I wonder what the hit ratio is for men hitting on women. It feels like it's a lot less than women hitting on men, but I wonder if you gave up right before you were going to get a positive hit, because it's a 1 in 5 ratio or something, or 1 in 10, who knows what it is, but...
Actually, Bob, I could cite a study for Jay here.
Okay.
There was a study that was done, and so it's a funny study. They had a very attractive man and a very attractive woman hit on 75 random people on a college campus. And all they were instructed to do, this hot man and this hot woman, was to go up to a random person and say, "Will you meet me at 7 o'clock in my apartment for sex?" And guess how many women said yes?
Zero.
Zero. It was something like 80% of the men said yes. Now the guy could get girls to give him his phone number to meet them again, to talk. And, you know, basically the guy had to work would have to work, even if he was really good looking, would have to work to get these women in bed, where the woman, you know, 80% of the guys were ready to have sex right then and there.
Now, I remember being on that conversation. John Larson brought that up on a Mormon Expression once. Do you remember what the source of that is?
No, but I could look it up.
Right, and just to be specific, Jay, you never got to phase two of this process that's required for men based on the study, in the sense that, like, you mentioned you didn't want to lie, and I'm assuming, you know, you were honest in your first impression with the woman in each case, rather than like flirting and then, you know, the second meetup, which by whatever hypothetical woman standards would be when sex could be on the table or the third meetup or whatever. You never even got it to that point because you would be honest at the first attempt each time. Is that correct?
Well, this is kind of a funny story, but there actually was one. And again, I didn't do this that often, so there's not a huge sample size, but I did get one number and we were going to hook up later, but I made the classic mistake of sending a text that I thought was a text to my wife to this girl, and that wasn't a good thing.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, because I was at work and I was busy and I was really excited that I had this woman's phone number, and so I was texting my wife about her and asking her, you know, what should I do next? You know, what's my next move with this woman?
How to close the deal with this girl that you just met.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh. And she's like, don't text me. Text her.
You highlight this interesting problem where that you really set up the rules so that you would fail and your wife would succeed, because your wife was offering everything that the men would want. That's sex without any connection, whereas you were offering sex without any connection, which is the opposite of what girls out there, I would think, want.
Well, I don't know. I can tell you, I went into this with eyes wide open. I had been given the advice that it was going to be very unbalanced, and you know, it was certainly unbalanced. My wife got way more attention than I did.
Is that why you put in that swap rule? You know, my turn, your turn rule. It was really for you, not for her.
No, maybe.
It was so that she wouldn't get, you know, 20 hits to your one, because you couldn't handle that.
Well, could you?
Well, I'm just asking.
Yes is the answer to that question.
Well, you know, it's possible. Who knows? You know, looking back on it now, we're just recreating the past and trying to make it all make sense. So, I guess that's possible. Sure.
Wait a second, but I have just to close the loop to follow up with Jay. So, Jay, you're saying that you did try the lie approach once, and then if you were religious, you would call it some sort of God intervention. If you're not, karma, bad karma, whatever you want to call it. But the one time you lie, you also screw it up with a fumbled text, and then for whatever reason, you never try lying again, not because it wouldn't work, but because you just fumbled the football that time and you didn't want to give it another go.
Well, no, it's not really that. Not soon after the fumbled text incident, we hooked up with that first couple. And so at that point, it was more about doing things with other couples than going out to bars anymore. So, you know, and then after that, we ended the experiment. So it was just more a matter of timing, actually, than a conscious choice to not try it again.
So, and just to clarify, the experiment has only recently ended, right? It's only been a few months.
Yeah, that's right.
That you put it on hold, because one of the comments I had from people that I had listened to it was that they didn't feel like it had really been long enough for you to judge whether it had been a success or not.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, if you listen to that first interview, I think I made it pretty clear that that experiment is over for now, but it's provisionally over. You know, my wife was the one who decided that we should end it because it was just so hard for her, and she saw how much I was hurt, and, you know, she just didn't want to have to put me through that anymore. But, you know, that you're right, it hasn't been a lot of time, but that's why we ended it the way that we did, and it's still, you know, we'll see what happens.
Is that what you really wanted, or did you want your wife to say, Jay, we're going to close it off after you get one more awesome catch? And then,
well, yeah, that would have been nice, but, you know, it was complicated because, on the one hand, it's really nice now that I don't have to worry about what my wife is doing, like I was before, you know, keeping score, keeping track, you know, those feelings of jealousy, they're gone because I completely trust my wife and I know that we're good. But, you know, on the other hand, when it was fun and it was good, it was really, really good and really fun. So I just want to, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, that's I hear a lot of conflict. I mean, having talked to you about this a couple of times now, you know, you'll say something like, this is a classic example of be careful what you wish for. But at the same time, I get a really strong sense that you don't want anybody to look at this as a cautionary tale.
Absolutely not.
You know, but at the same time,
it's a cautionary tale.
It's the classic example of be careful what you wish for. That to me sounds like a cautionary tale, but it's not a cautionary tale, you know.
Well, I really wish that I hadn't have said it or said it that way. It was just, I think a lot of people are going to be listening to this and they'll just laugh at me because I was the one who started this off and then my wife was the one who got all of the success from it.
But isn't that also the cautionary tale?
Well, it was for the, you know, going out to bars and that sort of thing, but not for the swinging part. You know, when we were with other couples, that was a completely different experience. So, it kind of is and it kind of isn't.
All right. Well, a special thanks to Jay for coming on and sharing his story with us and then joining us again for this panel discussion. I know that none of us really like these trite, oversimplified cliches, but seriously, what more can you say about this?
Anyone for the closing prayer?
Oops, I didn't know we couldn't talk about sex. Must have been.